Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Forget oil and gold. They're so passé when you're talking about commodities. What about the good stuff like soybean futures and pork bellies? If you can buy it or sell it, there is a market for it. Markets that, until this week anyway, had been doing pretty well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by LendingTree, where you can choose up to 4 customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us today. It is Thursday, March the 20th. I know I poo-pooed him a minute ago, but just as points of reference, here's where oil and gold closed today. Crude dropped 70 cents to $101.84 a barrel. Not a huge sell-off, sure, but at one point this morning it was under $99. Gold was down near $900 an ounce earlier. It closed off 3% at about $920. You know, Monday we were talking about $1,000 gold and oil above $110. Wheat, corn, and copper are just some of the other commodities that have been rising at record rates the past 6 months. But this week, those prices have been headed the other way. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out what pushed them up to begin with and why they're falling now.
It's hard to talk about commodities as a single entity. After all, the market for pork bellies is very different from the market for gold. Or grain, which is what was being sold in the background at the Chicago Board of Trade when I talked to Victor Lespinas today. He's with GrainAnalyst.com. He says there are some common factors to the big movements in commodity prices.
These hedge funds have been big buyers of numerous commodities, metals, energies, grains, and others.
And not just hedge funds. Regular old mutual funds and pensions have been getting in on the game, too. James Mound writes a newsletter about commodities. He says prices went up as investors bet there would be higher demand for commodities in the future, based on one simple thing.
Which is growth of foreign countries like China. And that's supported by the fact that we've had a weak U.S. dollar, and that's caused products to be cheaper to foreign consumers.
That weak dollar attracted foreign buyers to the American market because it made commodities cheaper. But when the Fed lowered interest rates on Tuesday, the dollar got stronger. So now commodities bought in the U.S. are more expensive for foreign buyers. They're backing out and bringing domestic investors with them. That's made commodity prices fall. So where is all the money going? Mound thinks a lot of people are just hanging on to the cash until they decide if they should put their money back in.
It's certainly not in real estate, and it doesn't appear to be in the stock market. You could make an argument that people are moving their money into treasuries.
Though treasuries may lose their appeal, he points out, with interest rates as low as they are. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Hillary Clinton weighed in on the economy today from out on the campaign trail. She wants a new stimulus plan, $40 billion this time, to help states buy up foreclosed homes and restructure some mortgages. Democratic Congressman Barney Frank was talking about Bear Stearns in Washington. The chairman of the House Financial Services Committee had an interesting idea. He wants the government, perhaps Mr. Bernanke and the Federal Reserve, to keep an eye on the risks that banks are taking and intervene in the markets if they need to. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson explores the economics of regulating risk.
Congressman Frank knew he had an uphill climb when he tried to convince bank reps in Boston this morning that the system needs more regulation. So he brought up his old adversary, Republican Dick Armey.
His second most famous comment was, markets are smart and government is dumb. Of course, when the dumb government had to bail out the smart people at Bear Stearns, we didn't hear from him. But
Frank wants to trade access for access. The government would have the last word on the risks financial institutions take, and those institutions would get help from the Fed when they're in trouble. The Wall Street Journal's Stephen Moore says the idea makes him cringe.
You know, risk shouldn't be treated as a four-letter word, as if it's a dirty word. The people who should be making the decision about what a prudent risk is are the people who are investing their own money.
But, says David Jones of DMJ Advisors, it's easier to argue against regulation of risk in good times. And he says this is the first time things have gotten really bad since huge risks became the centerpiece of Wall Street a few decades ago.
We just have never had a crisis large enough to test each of these areas of leveraged risk-taking with a big credit crisis till now.
But Jones has reservations about Frank's proposal, too.
The only hope I would have is that they would not throw a government blanket over all risk-taking, which is vital to the operation of our successful capitalist economy.
In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
For a lot of Bear Stearns shareholders, the company's collapse wasn't much short of disaster. Many employees saw their retirement funds evaporate along with the share price. But it's not doom and gloom for everybody. Some investors have done very well out of Bear's fall, the ones who, even before the events of last weekend, were betting the stock wouldn't last. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Most investors are optimists. They bet a stock will go up in value. But the hedge funds who've made millions on Bear Stearns' collapse were pessimistic about the company's prospects. Charles Jones teaches finance at Columbia Business School. He says taking the negative view is just a different way of playing the stock market.
They're looking to see whether these companies are going to be able to make any profits, whether they're going to have further write-downs that the market hasn't taken into account yet. They have an inkling or some information that suggests that things are worse than the market is putting into the price.
Occasionally, Jones says they'll have insider information. The Securities and Exchange Commission is worried that might have happened last week. A lot of investors made bets ahead of Bear's collapse that the share price would tumble. The Wall Street Journal says the SEC has launched an investigation.
They were the kind of bets that would only pay off if something dire happened to Bear Stearns.
One of the ways investors made money on Bear Stearns was by selling short. That's when an investor borrows shares, then sells them. He buys the shares back later when the price has dropped and makes a profit on the difference. Veteran NYSE trader Ted Weisberg says it's risky but potentially lucrative.
For whatever reason, stocks always seem to go down a lot faster than they can go up. And so therefore, if you are a short player and you are right on the short side, the opportunity to make a lot of money quickly is very compelling.
He says plenty of investors accentuate the negative in the hope of getting positive results. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson made an announcement today that for the first time in a good long while had nothing to do with the housing market or the liquidity squeeze. He's reached a deal with Abu Dhabi and Singapore over sovereign wealth funds. Abu Dhabi's got the world's biggest. Singapore's not far behind. Among other things, there's an agreement not to use those funds to further, quote, political goals. Yeah, that was another 200-point swing on the Dow today. Wall Street banks led the way up. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The White House confirmed today the president's still going to Beijing for the Olympics this summer. Press Secretary Dana Perino said the Chinese crackdowns in Tibet are no reason to cancel the trip. The Olympics, she said, are about athletics, not politics, which might be true. But the Games are about a whole lot of business, too. The big brand names that have plunked down hundreds of millions of dollars are paying very close attention to the politics. Scott Tong is in the Marketplace Shanghai Bureau. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
Scott, these companies, it's everybody from Adidas to IBM to Visa and Kodak. Do you think they're worried really about the consumer backlash here, that their sponsorship might hurt them in the marketplace?
I don't sense that there is panic among some of these companies. But one public relations person who's connected to these Olympic sponsors, and he's paid to worry, says the risks, they may be still low at this point, but they've gone up. And what he means is the risk of being associated with an Olympic Games whose reputation is kind of widely seen as being tainted. It's the image. It's the image of China and the companies that are associated with it. And the worry is not just what's happening in Tibet, but it's this cumulative snowstorm effect. There's Sudan and Darfur. There are bad pollution reports. You have the American athletes talking about eating their own food and not eating the local Chinese food. So you put it all together, and it's like the red light is kind of blinking on the dashboard. And the fear is this will become a chronic kind of bad news story all the way until the games start in August.
What can these companies really do about it, though, Scott? I mean, they're you know, corporate organizations. They're not you know, diplomatic people.
Well, that's right. What they can do is they can issue statements saying that. They're here to sponsor the Olympics, which is about sports. It's not a place for politics. Only a couple of them, Coca-Cola and Lenovo, have even mentioned Tibet. They've talked about expressing regret about the situation there. And they have their own situation coming up, because on Monday, the Olympic torch relay starts, and they're sponsors of this torch relay. And the Tibetan activists are planning to protest along the way and raise a lot of noise, especially when the torch is scheduled to go to Tibet later this year.
And Lenovo, of course, is a Chinese company.
Well, that's right. And what they want to do with these Olympics is to reach the international audience as well as the domestic Chinese audience, the billion people that are here, which, of course, is why all the other sponsors are here, too.
But that China market, Scott, I mean, these companies knew the risk-reward curve going in. China's a tricky place to do business.
Well, of course they did. And they knew that the risk in this case was what's going to be the iconic image of these Olympic Games. Is it going to be some Jamaican bobsledder moment, or is it going to be a tank? I mean, that's a real question still with these Olympics. The other risk that the companies face is they can't be seen as crossing China, because they'll go in a hurry, as one executive put it to me, from a friend of China to company non grata. And good luck the next time you want to get a factory permit. I mean, you get the silent treatment from China.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in Shanghai. Thank you, Scott.
All right, you're welcome, Kai.
Bond market's been an interesting place this week. Alisa Roth was telling us some of the money coming out of commodities seems to be heading over there as investors are looking for someplace safe to wait out the storm. The most exuberant bond market around doesn't have anything to do with Wall Street, though. Sukuk, bonds that are designed to conform to the rules of Islam, have been going gangbusters. $47 billion worth of them were issued last year. That's a 73% increase over just a year earlier. But Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports Islamic finance could be on the brink of its own credit crunch.
Islam prohibits the charging of interest. It's considered exploitation. Muslims believe that those who provide capital should either take a share of the profits or bear the losses of the enterprise they're backing. Humayun Dar teaches Islamic finance at the Cass Business School in London. He says the sukuk, or Islamic bond, cleverly circumvents this rule in a number of different ways.
For example, sukuk holders receive ownership of an asset, which is then leased to the issuer, which offers a rental.
But critics say that's just interest by another name. That bond is un-Islamic. A leading Muslim scholar, Sheikh Mohammed Taqi Usmani, says 80% of these bonds break the fundamental laws of Islam. Tariq El-Diwani, author of The Problem with Interest, says the sheikh is right. The banks have been hoodwinking Muslim investors.
They are engaging in legal trickery in order to produce a fixed financial rate of return from the outset of the transaction. Many of them are. Not all of them.
Special boards of Muslim scholars certify all the sukuk as Islamic. The trouble is, says El-Diwani, the banks pay those scholars, sometimes handsomely. Rather like an investment bank paying a rating agency, which then gives its conventional bonds a triple A. Hardly an independent opinion.
At the end of the day, I think it is a little bit much to expect a big banking organization to pay a scholar who says that the bank's products are not permitted under Islamic law. I mean, it's not going to happen, is it?
Sheikh Usmani's attack has sent shockwaves through the Islamic bond industry. His influential board has just issued tighter guidelines, and that's made many of the existing bonds look as if they don't comply with Islamic law. Andrew Hilton runs a financial think tank, the CSFI.
Many institutions around the world who hold Sukuk bonds might no longer be allowed to hold them. They might have to sell them because they wouldn't any longer qualify as qualifying investments for those institutions.
He says what's happening here is reminiscent of the unravelling of the conventional credit markets when packages of debt, including subprime mortgages, were suddenly stripped of their AAA rating.
It could indeed be the subprime meltdown of Islamic finance. It's something that many people have worried about for a while, quite terrifying for the institutions which actually have invested in these bonds.
Other analysts say this is not as terrifying as it seems. The bonds may have been stripped of their religious respectability, but the sheikh was right. Many of the bonds do pay healthy and fixed rates of return. There'll be plenty of non-Muslims lining up to buy them. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, putting the lid on greenhouse gases.
The whole point of a cap and trade program is the cap. You have certainty about reducing the particular pollutant, in this case greenhouse gases, over time, and you don't have that with a tax.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow popped 261 points today, 2.1% to close at 12,361. The Nasdaq climbed 48 points, 2.2% to 2258. The S&P 500 rose 31 points, 2.4% to 1329. For the week, and we're doing this now because everything's closed tomorrow for Good Friday, the Dow was up 3.4%. The Nasdaq climbed 2.1%. The S&P 500 stepped up 3.2%. Financials came storming back today. Lehman Brothers soared 15%. Citigroup rose 10%. J.P. Morgan up 8.25%. Nike scored a nearly 9% jump thanks to surging shoe and clothing sales in China ahead of the Olympic Games this summer. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. And by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business. The brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up tomorrow. Trading stalls for a day as most U.S. financial markets are closed in honor of Good Friday. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice meets with the Brazilian defense minister in Washington. And on March 21, 1961, Alcatraz locked up for good, ceasing operations. The federal penitentiary closed its doors to prisoners, but not tourists. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Juice isn't the beverage most of us think about when Russia is being discussed. There's borscht, but that's soup, I suppose. Vodka, of course. But today, Pepsi made $1.5 billion bet on the Russian fruit juice market. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The cola wars have been raging in this country for decades.
Pepsi's got that special taste.
Have a Coke and start looking up.
Look up.
Or looking overseas. That's where the drink wars are headed. And juice giant Lebedyansky is a huge score for Pepsi. It's the biggest player in the $3.5 billion Russian juice market. That market is growing about 13% a year. Mike White is the vice chairman and international CEO of PepsiCo. He says developing countries like Russia are a huge part of how the company plans to grow.
We have to remember that the U.S. is 5% of the world's population. And the U.S. business is still 65% of PepsiCo's revenue. So there's still tremendous opportunities for us, I think, outside the United States.
White says the deal is also part of Pepsi's expansion into healthier products. And that's crucial, says Gary Hemphill with research firm Beverage Marketing Corporation. Hemphill says soda is still the biggest earner in the beverage industry, but it's losing market share as consumers get more health conscious. So Pepsi and Coke have been diversifying.
The Cola Wars, they still exist, but they've morphed. They've become mini wars, if you will. There are sports drink wars, there are juice wars, there are bottled water wars. But I would say the battle between the two is probably as heated as ever.
Pepsi has recently snapped up Naked Juice and also owns sports drink Propel. Coke just bought Vitamin Water's parent company and a big stake in the organic Honest Tea. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Barack Obama made another speech today. This one was on the war in Iraq and its effect on the economy. He said the war is part of the reason oil prices are so high. Hillary Clinton was stumping in Indiana today, where she blamed oil company profits for rising gas prices. Most of that oil is not ours, of course. We buy it from overseas. But commentator Jerry Taylor says the notion of energy independence doesn't really hold water.
President Bush and many others are fond of saying that oil prices are high because we import too much oil. In reality, they've got it exactly backwards. We import energy for a reason. It's cheaper than producing it here at home. A governmental war on energy imports will, by definition, raise energy prices. Energy independence won't protect us against embargoes, because embargoes are nothing but symbolic gestures. Take the 1973 embargo. Instead of buying oil directly from Arab members of OPEC, we simply bought oil from people who bought oil from Arab members of OPEC. Oil imports actually went up during that period. And energy independence won't protect our economy from supply disruptions abroad. Say Saudi, Iranian, or Venezuelan crude oil production were to suddenly come to a halt. Oil everywhere would just become more expensive, no matter where it's produced. For instance, the loss of Iranian crude oil in 1978 sent British oil prices just as high as Japanese oil prices. The thing is, Britain was energy independent, while Japan depended entirely on imports. Energy independence won't necessarily guarantee more stable sources of supply. We could substitute gasoline for corn ethanol, but we would just be trading geopolitical risks for much larger weather-related risks. Energy independence won't win the war on terror. Even if we reduced oil consumption, and thus oil imports, enough to drive world oil prices down from current levels to, say, $20 a barrel, it would simply return us to the world of the 1990s. And as you may recall, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, and Saudi finance madrasas were doing quite well under those conditions. If you are a domestic oil producer, there is good reason for you to like the idea of energy independence. It drives out a long list of competitors from the American market, and it raises prices and fattens profits. For everyone else, energy independence makes no more sense than, say, food independence. There is no BTU exception to the case for free trade laid out in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations.
Jerry Taylor is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Take a moment to send us your thoughts about energy or whatever else you like. Our website is marketplace.org. Look for the link that says contact. The problems posed by high oil prices aside, there aren't many things the three remaining presidential candidates agree on. Global warming is one of them, though. Everybody still in the race for the White House endorses what's called cap and trade as the best way to reduce greenhouse gases. Carbon emissions would be limited, but companies would be able to sell whatever quota they don't use. Europe's already got a program. Some states here have theirs ready. But even among environmentalists, there is disagreement. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports now on greenhouse gases in the Golden State.
When California activist Angela Johnson Mazeros thinks about climate change, she focuses on the folks she says stand to lose the most on a warmer planet. And let's just say they don't live in Beverly Hills.
Look at Katrina as an example.
Mazeros says climate change may not have directly caused Hurricane Katrina, but global warming will likely bring more extreme weather just like it.
And you see who was impacted in New Orleans by that hurricane.
In 2006, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed a historic global warming bill. Now the state is working up a plan to cut emissions that includes a proposed cap and trade system for California. But environmentalists working in poor communities are fighting that approach. That puts them in direct conflict with many of the mainline green organizations here. Groups like Mazeros' California Environmental Rights Alliance are skeptical of a market-based approach. They say while cap-and-trade will force some refineries and power plants to clean up their acts, others will just buy carbon credits, and that means they'll just keep spewing CO2 and all the dirty pollutants emitted along with it.
Whenever we talk about addressing carbon and carbon reductions, we also have the opportunity to have reductions in co-pollutants, particulate matter, which we understand has very significant negative health impacts on communities.
On poor minority communities, Mazzero says, where most of these plants are located. She and her green allies say cap and trade is also too vulnerable to fraud and corporate manipulation. Just look at Europe, she says, where industry pressured regulators to hand out too many free permits and carbon prices plunged. Many of these environmentalists favor a carbon tax instead. That's a tax on greenhouse gas emitters. This group believes a tax would inspire fossil fuel reductions more quickly and more broadly. But Terry Tamminen, a key environmental advisor to Governor Schwarzenegger, doesn't believe it.
The whole point of a cap and trade program is the cap. You have certainty about reducing the particular pollutant, in this case greenhouse gases, over time, and you don't have that with a tax. And we would have to guess, how high would a tax have to be?
Tamminen and others here who support carbon trading argue it might take a heck of a tax to get people to stop using so much fossil fuel.
So if you want to get a guaranteed reduction in the use of gasoline and therefore the use in greenhouse gases from that source of emissions, you might have to charge a dollar a gallon or more.
And that, he says, would be a big burden on the poor. Tamminen's support of cap and trade is echoed by mainline environmental groups here like the Natural Resources Defense Council. NRDC's David Pettit says a tax may sound simpler, but for many, the T word is a non-starter.
There was a proposal during the Clinton administration to have a BTU tax, which went absolutely nowhere. And I am afraid that carbon tax might reach the same end.
This internal feud is slightly uncomfortable for the green community. Polite sniping is the result. Tamminen says the complaining about cap and trade threatens to paralyze progress on global warming. Activist Mazzero says her goal is reducing emissions, not just, quote, a political win. Mazzero's concedes, however, this trade versus tax debate has made for strange bedfellows. It's not every day she finds herself agreeing with the chairman of ExxonMobil. He says he'd prefer a carbon tax, too. In Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, I don't know if you saw it in the papers, but there was a big airwaves auction on Tuesday. The Federal Communications Commission sold off a chunk of the wireless spectrum, netted almost $20 billion. We learned today AT&T and Verizon were the big winners. Frontier Wireless, it partners with the satellite TV company EchoStar, got some as well. There were some losers, though. The block that was supposed to be shared with public safety agencies didn't get the minimum bid of $1.3 billion. Critics say the price was just too high. Those airwaves that are being sold are ones being given up by broadcasters who will switch from analog to digital next year. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow jumped 261 points, 2.1%. The NASDAQ rose 48 points, 2.2%. The S&P 500 floated up 31 points, 2.4%. Wall Street's closed tomorrow, don't forget. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, cashing in on brides-to-be.
We have a saying in our culture that, you know, tiras la casa por la ventana. That means you just throw everything out the window, because when it comes to weddings, people go in debt.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.